Welcome, everybody, to Wisdom from Our Neighborhood. This is the podcast of Paths to Understanding, which is formerly Neighbors in Faith and the Tracy Levine Center. Our mission is to bridge bias and build unity through multi-faith peacemaking. We do that through telling inspiring stories, nurturing multi-faith relationships, and encouraging folks to act together. Tonight's show is really about stories of compassion, forgiveness, and joint action. It is a part of the preparation for Interfaith Week, sponsored by both Holden Village and Paths to Understanding. We will have 6 nights of live webinars starting Sunday, July 19th and ending July 24th. The webinars will include interfaith conversation on the topic of us, them, and all, weaving our identities and common humanity within the unity of life. You will soon be able to register for those live webinars at www.holdenvillage.org. And those webinars will include both 3 nights of art and also 3 nights of conversation. So we'll hope you'll join us for those live conversations. But tonight we're really excited to have 4 folk on with us. The first is Nina Fernando, who serves as the program director at the Shoulder to Shoulder campaign, a multi-faith coalition of religious denominations and faith-based organizations committed to countering anti-Muslim discrimination and violence in the United States and building a society where all are treated with dignity and respect. She joined Shoulder to Shoulder team in August of 2017. Hi, Nina. Thanks for being here.
Hi, everyone.
And then we also have Elise DeGoor, who's the co-director of the Faith Action Network here in Washington State. She brings 3 decades of experience in mission-driven work in human services and advocacy. She's a lifelong resident of Washington State, born and raised in Yakima, and completing undergraduate education at Spokane at Gonzaga University, and making Seattle home since 1980s, including work at Northwest Harvest. Hi, Elise.
Hi, so good to be here with all of you.
I'm also happy to have with us tonight Race Bouillon, who's a peace activist and an IT professional. After graduating from, I'm going to say this wrong, Silet College? How did I do? In military school in Bangladesh, he joined the Bangladesh Air Force and was commissioned as a pilot officer following 2.5 years of vigorous training. In 2001, Race was shot in the face by Mark Stroman, a white supremacist seeking vengeance for the 9/11 tragedy. His time now is divided between managing a team of system engineers and data centers in Europe and touring the globe giving talks about the regenerative power of forgiveness. Race, thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm very happy to be here and glad to be among all the other panelists. Thank you.
Thank you. And then lastly, but not least, we have Shanta Premawardhana, the Reverend Doctor, who was most recently the Director for Interreligious Dialogue and Cooperation at the World Council of Churches based in Geneva, Switzerland. Shanta is the Director of Omnia Institute for Contextual Leadership. Previously, Shanta served as the Associate General Secretary for Interfaith Relations at the National Council of Churches of Christ based in New York. Shanta, thank you for being here from Chicago. So, you know, you all, this has been a very heavy time for all of us right now. Human beings, it seems, have a lot to figure out about how we're going to live with each other. And with the tragedies, among which George Floyd is only one, we're seeing kind of the dual original sins of America, the way colonizers treated Native Americans, but also people of color in general. And so all of these really difficult realities are kind of coming to the consciousness of many more people right now. And a lot of folk are struggling. And of course, part of the struggle is that the news only often shares the bad news. And of course, that's not a knock on journalists. We need journalists more than ever before. But sometimes we can get so focused on negative stories that we kind of get overwhelmed. And so tonight's episode is going to be mostly about positive stories that our panelists have experienced or heard about or witnessed and been part of, so that we can recognize that all across this country, there are people who are doing really excellent work in their community with people of other wisdom traditions and who are making a difference in their community. And tonight's a night to kind of focus on those stories. So we never really worked out who was going to go first, but I think maybe I'm going to pick on Nina. So Nina, can you share like a story or two of some positive things that folk are doing out there to make a difference in their own community?
Sure. So, you know, what felt like a decade ago, but also just so recent, like yesterday, we were hearing about the pandemic and the concerns for COVID increasing more and more. And, it really turned everything upside down in the way that we what we expected to do, and many of us in our organizations, but locally, and I'll say for myself, I am also pregnant, expecting my first baby, and so that really shifted so much for me personally as well as in our work. But some positive stories, we heard the measures for social distancing, and so we translated a lot of our programming into virtual spaces. But what we were really committed to was social distancing or physical distancing does not have to mean social isolation. And so one of the campaigns that we do every year over Ramadan is we uplift interfaith iftars or iftars open to interfaith guests around the country to show how Ramadan's an opportunity to get to know your Muslim neighbors. And we couldn't do that this year in quite the same way. So what we did was create an initiative called Welcome to My Table, where we paired households to one another so that they can share an iftar meal together and get to know each other on a more intimate level. And the response was amazing. We had so many different communities coming together in different ways on a small level, and really beautiful stories from that I'd be happy to share.
That's great. Well, why don't you share one of those right now while we kind of understand where you're going?
Sure. A fun household pairing. There were two interfaith couples, young Catholic and Muslim combination. And they were in two different parts of the country, and they felt so connected. They talked about families and decisions they had to make as a couple, and so much more that they even forgot to talk about Ramadan itself as they were celebrating their meal. There was another where two sets of teenagers were discussing and comparing notes with school and video games, which was so great. A New York City based couple paired with a couple in Minnesota and building really strong, having some really strong connections and conversations. So it was really great to hear some of that, sharing recipes and deciding upon a recipe before their dinner so that they could share a meal, virtually together. So really sweet stories like that.
That's really awesome. Thank you. Thank you, Nina. And I wonder, Race, if we could kind of go to you next. What are some positive stories you've been seeing out there about how people are crossing interfaith lines to do work in their community or to get to know each other?
Well, I mean, the situation we're living in right now, it reminds me of Charles Dickens, the famous quote that it was the best of the time, it was the worst of the time, right? Definitely, we are living in a time that we never imagined that in 2020 we will be facing this kind of tremendous, painful, unexpected, and also health issues. The COVID situation I'm talking about, that we'll be facing something like this in our lifetime. But at the same time, it also kept me very hopeful as well, seeing how people are coming together on the street, how people are raising their voice, how people are showing solidarity. Doesn't matter who they are, where they come from, they're standing up for humanity. And that really, give me the hope that no matter how challenged our life is today, there is hope for a better tomorrow, because people are waking up, people are coming together, and they're standing up for each other. That's huge.
Yeah. Thank you, Race. Shanta, how about you? You got any stories that you have experienced over time that you might want to share with us? Oh, I think you're muted, brother.
Sorry about that.
It's okay.
sitting here trying to figure out which one, I mean, among a variety of stories. Well, I think that the one that I want to say doesn't particularly fit the COVID-19 situation or the protests here. My work is in different parts of the world. It is in Nigeria, in the northeast of Nigeria, where Boko Haram is active. It is in Sri Lanka, and it is in Bangladesh. Several of us have connections to those countries. What we do is we build interfaith peacemaker teams. We bring religious leaders and people of faith together in order that they might both collaborate, build power, and think strategically about local actions that are small enough to win. And as they win those actions, they are able to gain more power in order that they might win bigger actions. So that's the strategy. Today we have 71 interfaith peacemaker teams in Nigeria, 21 in Sri Lanka, and 15 in Bangladesh. And in each of these situations, we have interreligious communities coming together to address the local situation. The question, the story that I like to tell among all of the variety of stories is probably the one that comes out of Sri Lanka. You'll probably remember that Easter Sunday of last year, there was a bombing situation. And three churches and three hotels were bombed during that time. And there was an extremist Muslim group that was involved in that. The tensions between Muslims and Hindus and Christians and Buddhists have been very severe for a long time, particularly because there are some extremist Buddhist monks that are rousing up the people, particularly against Muslims and Christians. So this is a very complex situation. The story I want to tell you is about a village in the East Coast, south of Batticaloa, if you know that town. Nina knows all of this. There's a little village called Periyanilavane. Periyanilavane has the whole area has a lot of Muslims. In fact, some of the people who created the problem for the Easter Sunday bombing came out of a town just south of Batticaloa. In Periyanilavane, this young woman who is our leader there wanted to bring Muslims and Hindus together. She is a Christian, but her attempt was to bring Muslims and Hindus together. There was enormous tension during that period because of the bombing that took place, and of course all kinds of rumors that go on that are derogatorily aimed at Muslims, and so because of these rumors people don't trust each other. So she had a really hard time trying to bring these people together. Well, when I went there shortly after, maybe 3-4 months after that bombing, they were in the thick of this tension. And they couldn't even, I asked them to come for a meeting. They couldn't even sit still for a bit without starting to accuse each other. Mm-hmm. So it was that kind of situation that took place. Well, 6 to 8 months later, when I went out there in February of this year, things had changed substantially. And primarily because of this young leader's, her name is Devika. Devika's work, she had done tremendous work to bring the two groups together so that they might begin to understand and learn from each other. How did she do that? By getting them to help each other in their local cottage industry work. You know, they all do little projects that some have received micro loans to do various kinds of projects. And she figured out a way of getting the Hindus and the Muslims to work together in order to help each other. Suddenly, when you're working together with somebody, the stereotypes fall away. It's not even like sitting around and talking. When you actually do something, you build a relationship that is perhaps more, that is perhaps deeper and more long lasting than otherwise. And so this time when I went, well, people were talking and they were excited and they wanted to do stuff. And, how can we've done so much. How can we take this to the next level? You know, that's the conversation. I think that's the primary lesson for me in that story. My inspiration for that, as you all would probably know this name, a man named Millard Fuller, who wrote a book called The Theology of the Hammer. Millard Fuller is the founder of Habitat for Humanity. Mm-hmm. And Millard Fuller said in that book, when he's talking about Jews and Christians in that situation, but when a Jew and a Christian would get together and take 2x4s and hammer a nail together, that is far better than any dialogue that we might have, because they have done something, because they have built a house together. It lasts for a long time. That's the lesson of the story as well.
Shakta, thank you so much. And now I'd like to ask you, Elise, if you want to offer a story.
Well, I would be happy to pick up from where you left off there with the theology of the hammer and doing something together. So the work that I do with Faith Action Network is bringing together a fairly new, only 9 years old, which is fairly new in the scheme of things, interfaith network to do advocacy for social justice, both in their local, state, and at the federal level together. And, you know, just finding our common ground and finding the points where we agree on care of neighbor and, you know, love for each other, and to create, you know, more justice in the world, just gets us so much further down the road. And I love the hammering together. I really do that. Love that. But so maybe we're hammering out justice in kind of a policy wonky way.
That, you can sing it.
Right, if I had a hammer. So that's where I come to this work from. I think it was really Paul Nitter who first proposed that idea, theologian who, you know, said we're going to go much further interfaith if we work together, if we get our hands dirty together. So the story, and you know, there's no, I'll just tell you about something. I guess that's a story. I have been lucky in my life to attend a couple world events that had interfaith participation. And those really opened my eyes and deepened my commitment. And the first one was the Beijing Women's Conference in 1995, where there was a very strong women theologians track in that. And really good stuff, really great collaboration, theologians and spiritual activists from all over the world. And many of those conversations would be interrupted by women from other parts of the world who said, get your religion out of my politics. Get your religion out of the way of my well-being. And both were true, right? There was such beauty and truth, and there was interference of religion in their countries and in their well-beings. So from that experience, I saw that, you know, spirituality, religion, faith has both the ability to annihilate us and to bring us together. And those are really powerful, you know, two sides of the equation. The other world event that I feel like really highlighted more the ability to bring us together is the Parliament of World Religions. I've been able to attend the last two, and that is just such a beautiful gathering to me of, you know, I believe most every faith represented, and no sense of the annihilation, really, coming together with goodwill and to learn from each other. And when I'm in those kinds of situations, I just question, how can we not build a better world? And thank God we have faith. We have spirituality, we have our traditions to guide us into creating the world we want to be part of. So I'll leave that there.
Yeah, thank you, Elise. You know, a couple of stories that come to my mind. First, you know, the organization that I'm part of was started because a rabbi who experienced pogroms in Lithuania, where they were shouting in the streets about killing Jewish folk. He recognized the anti-Catholic bigotry against that was coming up during the election of John F. Kennedy, and he realized like the potential for violence that comes out of that kind of speech and bigotry, and so he helped put a TV show together, eventually with a Roman Catholic priest who in Ireland had experienced a religious discrimination toward Catholics, where they had to actually go out into the forest to be able to celebrate Mass. And those two formed a really powerful friendship and really modeled for a lot of people how we can both be faithful to our tradition, but at the same time experience unity and humanity and learn from and with others. I want to share a story about Willmar, Minnesota, where Nina in her work invited me out to Willmar, Minnesota. And you wouldn't thought that there would be much work going on in Willmar, Minnesota interfaith-wise. But there I met, thanks to Nina and Catherine and Shoulder to Shoulder, a young Muslim woman who had been attacked in high school and had a wound physical wound, and who together with a young Lutheran woman were really leading a movement of unity to overcome some of the white supremacy and the anti-Muslim bigotry that was there in Willmar. And both of those women, so powerful, and their relationship was incredible. And to see those like 40, 50 people in that little community center, you know, learning how to counteract anti-Muslim bigotry and how to build their own skills. Like, it just makes you think, you know, whenever we used to fly in airplanes, you know, but even now we still drive around sometimes. And in every community we see, in every neighborhood, there are people like that working, you know. The last little story I would share here comes back to the story of that Shanta, you know, shared. A few days after that terrible tragedy in Sri Lanka, there was a commemoration at the Roman Catholic at the cathedral in Seattle, and I was pleased to be able to be there, sitting next to a Sikh leader, and then a Baha'i next to me, and then a Buddhist right behind me, and then as we went outside after the service was over, the Muslim community brought flowers, and they gave a small bouquet of flowers to every Christian that was there, saying that we're so sorry that attack happened on the Christian community. And it was so beautiful to be in that space with all those well-intentioned people who were well-intentioned because of their faith tradition and who knew each other from many other activities and efforts, to be able to share that grief, you know, with each other. And I think that, again, that there are stories like that in every community. If we could just lift them up and just remember them. Are there any stories anybody else would like to share here for a minute? Anything else anyone would like to share? Race?
Sure, I would be happy to share my story in a briefly. So again, you know, the point you just mentioned, that we have the human capacity to get beyond our bitter experiences and you know, past mistake, prejudice, intolerance, and we have the capacity to treat each other as human first, regardless of the past bitter experience. And so my story goes, you know, talks about this point as well, that, so let me take a step back first, that after, as you mentioned, that I served in the Bangladesh Air Force. So after graduating as a pilot officer from the Bangladesh Air Force, I did not feel my destiny was there. And my American dream kept calling me. Eventually, I left my career, my home, and my family for New York City to pursue additional additional higher education. Growing up watching Wild Wild West movies, I could not resist the invitation to visit Dallas, Texas. Excited to see the ranches, cowboys, and bars with their famous swinging doors. Though I never did find one. I moved to Dallas a few months before 9/11, working in a friend's convenience store by day and working and studying computer science by night. It did not take me long to realize my life in America would never be the same. 10 days after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, as I stood behind the counter, a man walked in holding a double-barrel shotgun, pointing at my face directly. And he asked, "Where are you from?" And before I could say anything more than "excuse me," he pulled the trigger from point-blank range. On my way to the hospital, I promised God that if you'll let me live, I would do good things with my life. What happened as a result of this shooting, I underwent several eye surgeries. Unfortunately though, I lost vision in one eye. The right side of my face and skull was and remains peppered more than 3 dozen bullet fragments. And I lost my job, my home, my sense of security, and my fiance, but gained more than $60,000 in medical bills. And you know, there is not a single day that goes by that I am not reminded of this painful tragedy, but I continue to make peace with my pain. And my shooter, Mark Stroman, killed 2 South Asian men, one from India and one from Pakistan, during his 9/11 retaliation shooting spree. And he claimed he was hunting Arabs, but not one of his victims was Middle Eastern. And after his arrest, he told the news media that what he had done, most Americans wanted to do, they just didn't have the guts. He claimed that he was a true American, he was a patriot, and he blamed me and my kind for 9/11. Mark was tried and was sentenced to death by lethal injection. Though I had forgiven Mark after I got my life back, it wasn't until I was in Mecca for the pilgrimage that I began reflecting back on my shooting and my would-be killer sitting on death row waiting to die. And I imagined myself in his situation. And instead of hating him, I saw him as a human being like me. I saw him not just a killer, I saw him as a victim too. I felt that I suffered terribly, but I did not see any value in him suffering as well. My faith and my upbringing gave me the courage not only to forgive Mark, but also fight to save the life of the man who tried to end mine. I returned to the US and launched an international campaign, including visiting the headquarters of Lundbeck, the lethal injection manufacturer in Denmark, and was able to convince them to urge the governor of Texas not to use their product to kill human beings. And I was surprised that after our visit, Lundbeck announced that they would stop supplying this drug to the US prison that carry out execution. I also went to the US Supreme Court asking for clemency for my attacker. And in the meantime, Mark came to know about me and the diverse coalition of Muslims, Jews, Hindus, Christians, and atheists. And that was the most beautiful part, that people from all walks of life, they came together and rallied to get him removed from death row. And I was told that he was stunned and deeply touched by our efforts. And he called me brother in a phone conversation. And he hated me when he didn't know me, but in the end said he loved me. So you see that forgiveness and kindness had a tremendous effect on my attacker. And I was not only him, but also on his family members who came forward to meet me later and who now treats me as one of their family members. And so though Mark, suffered from tremendous childhood abuse and trauma, a lack of love, education, guidance, living much of his life embroiled in ignorance, hate, and violence. He actually ended his life in peace, receiving love, kindness, and mercy from the very people he once hated, renewing his faith in Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, and in humanity. His last words were, before he was executed, "Hate is going on everywhere. It has to stop. Hate causes a lifetime of pain." And he was executed in 2011. And I didn't stop there. I established a nonprofit called World Without Hate. And I share my story locally, nationally, and internationally in hopes of inspiring people to get beyond the prejudice, ignorance, intolerance, hate, and violence, and treat people as human first, regardless of who they are, where they came from. Because that is our first identity. We all are human beings. We all are God's children.
Grace, thank you so much. And I'm just, I'm so inspired by your story, and as well as that, just that simple part of the story where going to Mecca for your pilgrimage, and how powerful a moment that was for you, where you saw that the core of your faith, the core of the Islamic tradition, you know, is to forgive and to do good to those that harm, you know, us. And I'm just so touched by that. And I wonder now, I didn't bring this question up to all y'all, but do we have other, first of all, do we have other stories of forgiveness like that? And what is it about that, the spiritual traditions, the wisdom traditions, you know, that offer us a path toward that? So I'm just gonna open that up to any of you that wanna speak. Nina, how about you?
Sure. You know, there's so many thoughts that are coming to mind. I was raised in a Catholic family and Sri Lankan immigrant parents. And though, you know, I'll never, you know, fully understand what it means to be Black or Indigenous or Muslim, I work for this organization, Shoulder to Shoulder, addressing anti-Muslim discrimination. I do know what it feels like to be made to feel like you don't belong. And that is, you know, something that so many of our communities, our brothers and sisters are facing. You know, I think about from my Catholic upbringing, you know, we were just talking about theology of the hammer. I'm thinking about St. Francis, who was my confirmation saint, a quote, you know, "We should seek not so much to pray, but to become prayer." And what does that mean to become prayer in our lives and in the work that we do? And I think about, you know, I learned about this this story, this true story in history with this relationship between Saint Francis and the Sultan Al-Kamil during the height of the Crusades. These two leaders met and had a relationship, and in the midst of the war, you know, there was a lot of hatred, a lot of misinformation being spread about the Muslim community in particular. There was a moment where the Crusaders were dying from starvation. There was a flooding of the Nile, and the army was trapped. There was 50,000 people, you know, based on this relationship that they had formed and this friendship and the compassion drawn upon the Sultan's faith, he offered food to the people and essentially saved them. And this was the impetus to the end of the war, the end of the long, long war. And it's incredible what we can do. And that's a story on a very large scale. But there are so many stories of just small relationships being built, individual relationships that are being built around the country. You know, I think about St. Cloud, Minnesota. There are, you know, now that we're going virtual, there are you know, culture sharing sessions and story sharing sessions that are happening between the mostly Christian community and a Somali Muslim community in some of those spheres. There are, you know, folks standing up against hate crimes and saying, you know, hate has no home here. We are stronger together as a community, united. There are, you know, unique kind of creative solutions being formed. There was a story with ICNA Relief. It's a Muslim relief organization working on a variety of issues, including addressing hunger. They have food banks all over the country. And, you know, there was a moment in time where there was no toilet paper or flour in the grocery stores. And there was a need for flour in one of their food pantries. And it was through their relationships with a local Presbyterian church that ended up providing the flour. And then together they solved this problem to be able to feed the hungry in their community. And so it's so many of these stories that make an impact and can really change the harmful narratives that we are hearing.
Thank you, Nina. And I just want to say, if anybody has any questions on Zoom or on Facebook, just be sure and type those in, and we'll try to get those questions, you know, answered. It, you know, one of the stories that I just like to share briefly is of someone I work with quite a bit, and many of us know, which is, who is Sister Anila, you know, Afzali, you know, who is a Harvard-trained lawyer, and was a partner in a law firm at a very early age, and could be making, you know, some major bank right now, you know, but had a spiritual transformation and then began to see how anti-Muslim hate groups were not only causing pain and for Muslims, but for the people who were feeling the hate, and for those that you know, in the Jewish community and in other communities that are impacted when someone starts to go down the road of hate. And it's been such an amazing journey to watch her engage so many different communities that are under pressure, and to see her deep religious commitment, you know, not simply as something that's good in and of itself, which it is, but to see it as a gateway and as a source of strength for how she recognizes the human beings in other people. And I've learned so much from her and from her willingness to change her career and just like go a completely different direction. And to watch her, I remember one powerful symbol during 2017, or 2016, there was a big protest in Seattle. I'm sorry, 2017. And this woman was in a wheelchair and had this sign on her lap, an anti-Muslim, you know, sign. And Anila just was sitting at an Ask a Muslim booth, and Anila just kneeled down and talked with her and engaged with her. And you could see the woman change in that conversation. And this goes back to something that I think all of you have said in one way or another, that it's easy to hate someone when we don't know them. It's much harder to hate when we begin to know. And I've learned from Shanta, you know, that knowing about another faith is a good thing. Knowing a person of another wisdom tradition is more powerful, but then beginning to work together with them, you know, is just a whole other level. And I think, you know, all of you tonight, you know, represent organizations and in the work that you do, help people, you know, follow that path of knowing and getting to know people individually, and then beginning to do work together. Does anybody else have a little thought or a short story they'd like to share here before I ask you another question?
I can share a small, short story. I was flying from Seattle to Philly on a red eye flight, and I was already upset because I got a middle seat all the way back. But then I'm always an optimistic person. So I said, I'm going to make the best use of this middle seat in the red eye flight all the way back. So when I got my seat, then I saw a lady shorter than me approach. Looks like she needs some help to put her luggage in the overhead bin. So I said, can I help you? And she kind of like gave me a look as if yes or no, I'm not sure. Then I said, I don't charge. And it cracked her up right there. She said, sure. So I helped her with the luggage, and then she sat next to me and she said, "You're too funny." I said, "Was it too tough to put a smile on your face?" She said, "Of course not." I said, "Now I'm glad that you were smiling." So she shared chewing gum and said, "Would you mind?" I said, "Of course not. My mom taught me when people share something, take it. Even if you don't have the intention to eat it right there, but take it as a courtesy and then do whatever you do next later." So I did that. And then she was very friendly, and she told me that, "I just came from Jordan and Israel, and would you like to see some photos?" I said, "Wow, this stranger now would like to show her pictures that from overseas." So we were watching, and then she said, "What is your faith?" I said, "I'm a Muslim." And I asked her, "What do you know about Islam and Muslim?" She said, "Oh, you guys are supposed to kill or convert to go to heaven." So I did not take it personally. I just gave her a smile and I said, "How do you know this, and where do you know all this from?" She said, "It's everywhere. It's from internet, from journal, news media, everywhere." I said, "Have you ever met one before?" She said, "Not really." I said, "Welcome to this flight. You're sitting one of them. You're sitting next to one of them in a red-eye flight." So I joked and I said, jokingly. And then we connected. We had a very good discussion for almost half an hour. And I said, "If that is true, that a Muslim is supposed to go to heaven by killing or converting a person from the other faith, then I should be the happiest person in this world, because a person from Christian faith was supposed to be executed on my name. So instead of saving, fighting to save his life, I should be throwing party that I got a passport to go to heaven. But I did the opposite, because my faith did not teach me that. My faith taught me to show humanity, show forgiveness." And I shared my story pretty briefly, and we bonded pretty strongly right there. And we took a nap for a few hours. Once you wake up in the morning, she said, "I never read a Quran, but you inspired me. I'm going to read one. And how can I visit a mosque? Do I have to ask your permission?" She said, "No, you just walk into any mosque. Just tell them I'm here to visit. And you can read Quran that way. I read Bible. I read Torah for my own knowledge, for my own sake. And there's nothing wrong with that. You can be more knowledgeable. You can understand the other faith better by reading their spiritual, not by this scriptures." So from strangers, we connected very positively. And the ignorance, the fear she had before meeting me, it was already gone. And she said, "Once I go back, I will visit a mosque and I read Quran. And I will tell all my congregation that I met a Muslim in a red-eye flight. And we all survived, and we all went to our destination successfully."
So right now, you know, we're awash in a lot of hard stories, and I think the hard stories are important, you know, for us. You know, the story about, you know, George Floyd and so many other people. It's important for us to hear those difficult stories and begin to work through some of the denial about the way structural institutional racism has impacted everyone, but especially people of color in the country. But I think there's also a tendency, as I said before, in the news media, to kind of only focus on the negative and sometimes to focus on the stories in a way that doesn't really analyze the roots of things. But there are people out there, I think, tonight, you know, listening, who may be feeling, you know, is there, or wondering if there's any hope for the human race. And I guess I'm just wondering tonight what you four wise people would say to folk if they're starting to wonder a little bit if there's any hope for us. Who'd like to go first? Elise?
Oh, just picking up on where we've been and where you want us to go. I guess I've reflected a lot during this COVID and, time of two pandemics, as we say, just systemic racism rearing its ugly head once again. It's always been there, but in a bigger way. And COVID-19, I've just done a lot of pondering of history, really. I've taken some comfort, I guess, in historical fiction, in just looking backwards to all the places we've been before. And what struck me is that we have been in horrible places before. And we didn't always, not everybody fared very well through those times. But I'm struck by, I think it's Valerie Kaur who speaks of revolutionary love. And I think that is key to me of this forgiveness. And I even like, because I spent a lot of time in this room lately with these books, I picked up this very old book, Revolutionary Forgiveness, which was reflections from a group of people who went to Central America and said, how do we rebuild lives? How do communities rebuild their lives after going through civil war? And I think that story can be told over and over in every country of Central America and many other countries, of course. But we're at a time, I feel, where the divisions are so deep that we need to go back and look at when, you know, South Africa had to figure out how to move forward after apartheid. You know, how do we get to that revolutionary love that can lead to revolutionary forgiveness and rebuild lives? So I think we have a lot of great wisdom sources of people who've been through it before. It'll be different, but.
Yeah, Shanta, what would you say to someone who's feeling a loss of hope right now? Oh, I think you're muted there, brother.
I think they need to look at the protests that are going on. I think that's where the hope is. And the hope is not in the churches or mosques or...
Okay, we know Shanta's been... having some internet issues today. So Shanta, start over again. That'll be just fine.
Okay. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
The hope is in the protests that are going on, and in the protests we are discovering that that it is the young people who are leading us to the place of hope. It is really not the churches or synagogues or mosques or any other religious institutions, but it is the ones that are determined to make a difference in this world. A hope is not just something that comes out of the air. It comes out of hard work. It comes out of putting your, as I like to say, strapping your faith to your feet and walking and marching and agitating. That's how it happens. So I take a lot of hope from the to be directed, guided in some ways.
So Shanta's email or internet is continuing to give him some trouble. Nina, I wonder what you would say.
Yeah.
Sure. I'm so, you know, I totally agree with all that has been said. And I'll add, you mentioned Valerie Kaur, Elise, earlier. And actually, I this was not planned, but today she released her new book, See No Stranger. Today is that day that it's coming out. And really, I do want to draw upon some of her words that she shared just after the 2016 elections. She said, you know, what if this darkness that we're experiencing, the darkness of xenophobia, racism, you know, discrimination, anti-immigrant, anti-refugee, anti-Black, you know, you name it, the darkness that we're seeing in this society, what if it's not just the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? And I just love that image, especially now being pregnant myself. And she asks, you know, what is the midwife? What is the wisdom of the midwife? The midwife says to breathe first. So let's breathe together. Let us center. Let us educate ourselves. Take responsibility and onus and ownership of you know, the shape of our society. And then we push. And we birth a new future, and that imagery is so beautiful. And you know, thinking about, unfortunately, we've been through such a long labor, and does it feel like it will ever end? And you know, I can't see you know the future ahead, but I do see so much beauty now in the present of people coming together and pushing. and marching and educating themselves and speaking out against anti-Muslim policies or anti-Black policies or, you know, anti-immigrant, anti-refugee, you know, whatever that we're seeing. And that is so beautiful to see in this long labor that we're in.
Grace, brother, what do you want to share to someone who's feeling a loss of hope right now?
Well, you know, as a very optimistic person, I will share what I did in my darkest time in my life and how I was able to, you know, get my life back on track from the rock bottom situation and how I was able to, you know, choose the path of empathy and forgiveness and which helped me and my attacker, you know, to move forward and also get beyond our bitter experiences. So hope is one thing, but in order to make change, we have to combine action with hope. Merely hope will not, you know, give us the change that we look for. So in a situation, you know, in a hard situation, how can we stay, you know, how can we find hope and remain optimistic? So what I did, I deeply thought about the people, you know, who had a harder life than me. Thank God I got my life back. I was blinded only one eye, but I thought about it could have been worse. I could have blinded in two eyes. I could have brain damage. It could have been worse in many, many ways. So I thought about that. It's not all bad. Yes, I'm going through now some, you know, pretty tough time in all aspects, mentally, physically, psychologically, financially, but there are people who are worse situation than mine. So I thought about the people, you know, who had a harder life. It helped me a lot. I trusted, I did not lose my hope, my faith and my dreams and my faith in God. I trusted that things will get better today or tomorrow. And I focused on blessings, not only on the issues, only on the, you know, pain and suffering. I thought about that I'm still alive. I have education. And I'm in the greatest country in the world, in America, and there is a system that works if you want to make a change in your life. And then people came into my life who helped me a lot. So I focused on the blessings as well. And I did my best to stay positive and look for positive in every situation. It was very painful, but I always kept myself awake for finding the positive things. And what I did, I also made a short-term goal and long-term goal to get beyond, you know, the pain and suffering. So I went back to school. I started working in restaurants for $2.13 per hour. It gave me an opportunity to overcome my fear and ignorance and get to know more about people, about American culture. So it was a short-term goal to get beyond, you know, the pain and suffering and the fear. It helped me to achieve my long-term goal as well, to get into the IT and American corporate. So, I mean, to summarize it, that we need to stay positive. You know, think about other people who could be in a more, much harder shape, and also read something positive. Watch a documentary, uplifting, inspiring documentary film. You know, or read about your heroes or about, you know, the people see as a role model, read their, you know, about their life history, how they were able to successful and how they were resilient in their lives. That helps a lot. And at the same time, we need to find ways to, you know, forgive each other, you know, the people who hurt us in the past or who are causing any kind of, you know, pain and suffering to us. We need to find ways to forgive them and let them know that I forgive you and I'm trying to move forward and you do the same thing to me as well. So if we forgive each other, it will help us to get beyond our bitter experience, and it will help us to build a one united and peaceful country for all of us.
You know, I find myself, of course, as a Christian and Christian pastor, inspired by Jesus, you know, whose stump speech was, the time is now, repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near. The kingdom of God has come near, the reign of God. Or the way I would say it is God's way of mutuality, of living in mutual respect, is come near. And so there was both hope and there was also hard work in it. And during this last year, I've been part of a group in Anacortes working for equity, racial equity in Anacortes after a noose was hung in a city park. A clear message to all the people of color in our town. And included in that group, you know, we have Asian Americans and African Americans and people who are LGBTQ and you know, folk of the whole, you know, all the hues, as some of our members like to say. And one of them is a Native American woman who said, after all that's happened to my people, what I really want, what we really want is to find a way to live together because we're all here now. And if I can see hope amongst people of color, people who've experienced institutional and structural and interpersonal bigotry, who've gone through so much, and if they can have hope, if they can long for a way for us to live with each other, then really, who am I to not feel hope? Who am I not, at least, even if I don't feel it, to act out of that? And that hope for a better way for human beings to live is at the heart of, I think, all the Abrahamic traditions, so that we can learn to be a blessing to all the nations of the world, all the families of the world, and that's really God's mission statement, is to be a blessing to all the different families of the world, and so therefore that's kind of our mission statement too. And so when I get down, as I have been down this last week or so, I think about those friends of mine who've experienced far more of the terror than I have, and their hope. And I think back to the great leaders of the Abrahamic tradition, Moses and Jesus and Muhammad, who all faced terrible situations, and who knew Moses had to go back to Egypt, and Jesus had to go to Jerusalem, and Muhammad had to try to lead a different vision for how to be human in a time of oppression in Mecca. So there's just so many stories like that, I think, that we can draw from and find new hope. And as you said, Race, I think as all of you said, find new hope in action with our walking boots on. So with that, I think we're getting close to the end of our time. And I just want to thank all of you. I know Shanta, his internet's kind of bad, so he's sort of dropped out here, but we're so thankful to Shanta and to Nina and to Elise and to Race. Thank you all for being on the program tonight. I want to let everybody know that you can find out more about our organization at pathstounderstanding.org. Be sure and check out Challenge 2.0, hosted by Jeff Renner, on our YouTube channel. And we're launching a new podcast series with all the audio from all of our Challenge 2.0 programs, as well as Wisdom from Our Neighborhoods. We encourage you as well to check out our Facts Over Fear campaign, which is countering anti-Muslim bigotry during this time of COVID and in this election year. And I just encourage all of you to be well, be calm, and be good to your neighbors. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Elise. Thank you, Nina.